It's 4:06 and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Gene Purcell, filling in for Rob Ferret. Coming up, we today saw another hearing about a proposed bipartisan redistricting bill, and we will check in on the latest.
First, a lot of automakers have mini cars out on the market. They've also gotten some interest in part because they get good gas mileage. They're easy to park, too, especially in the city.
And a recent round of testing set out to see just how safe 11 different models of mini cars are, and many of them wound up coming up short.
Joe Nolan is with us now. He's Senior Vice President for Vehicle Research at the Insurance Institute for Highway Safety, which conducted the test. Joe, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's good to be on.
Well, let's start off with some definitions here. So a mini car, what exactly is a mini car?
Well, we classify vehicles by their size and also their weight. And what we call a mini car has a curb weight typically under 2,500 pounds, whereas a small car would be up to about 3,000 or 3,200 pounds.
Can you give us some examples of the cars that fall into that category of a mini?
Well, I'll use one manufacturer's product line, Honda. So Honda has the Fit, which is a mini car, the Civic, the next size up, is a small car, and then the Accord is a midsize car.
Okay, so you're going by weight here. And let's talk about some of the results that you saw across the safety categories.
Well, unfortunately, they're not good. Of the 11 models we tested, only one manages to avoid a marginal or poor rating. That's the Chevy Spark. It earned our second highest rating of acceptable. But in a field of 11, that's not stellar news.
So what are the ratings? You mentioned marginal and poor, and is acceptable the highest you can get?
Yeah, we rate vehicles good, which is the highest, acceptable, marginal, and then poor.
And so this Chevy Spark got a marginal?
No, an acceptable.
An acceptable.
The best scoring vehicle in this group, and as such, it earns what we call a top safety pick designation.
See, that's interesting because the New York Times story that I read about these new safety results shows a Chevy Spark, of which there's only a third of it left. It's in a crash, and it doesn't look like anything you'd want to be in, and that's the best scoring car. What did the worst scoring car look like?
Well, it looked like that and then some. So in addition, what's happening in these crashes is the structure of the vehicle isn't designed to absorb the crash forces and energy up in the front in the crumple zone where it should, and instead it manages to make its way all the way back into the occupant compartment. And so they're using the occupant compartment to absorb crash energy, and that means it's crushing. And that's where you sit. And the crushing contributes to injury. It also contributes to what we call bad kinematics. That means the motion of the occupant is not ideal for safety. So we've got the driver occupant is moving away from the airbags, in some cases barely touching them, because the steering column is being pushed out to the right and the occupant's moving to the left. And that's what happens when you lose structural containment of the occupant cell.
Now, these cars have been around for a while now. They're gaining popularity. We mentioned the fuel efficiency and the maneuverability, things like that. Is this the first time that we've really looked closely at how safe they are?
Well, we've been testing mini cars for years. And to be fair, this is a test we just added 2 years ago. So it's a new challenge, but an important one. About a quarter of all frontal crashes that result in injury or death are in this type of crash condition. And so, in essence, we've raised the bar 2 years ago, and this is our first look at how the mini cars are holding up.
What kind of crash test is this? What makes it different?
It's what we call a small overlap crash. It would be if two cars are driving in opposing directions on a country road, and one vehicle were to swerve into the other car's lane, so that only about a quarter of the vehicles or a third of the vehicles line up. So it's a little bit like wheel-to-wheel engagement. So not quite almost a side swipe, but not much.
So these are crashes that happen routinely on the road, but we haven't really been testing for them. Why are these mini cars so vulnerable to this particular kind of crash?
Well, I don't think there's any reason that mini cars are at special risk. I believe these vehicles just haven't been designed for this crash condition yet. You know, we've seen vehicles of varying sizes, do well, And so there's no a priori reason that a mini car is worse. It just happens to be that most of the vehicles in the market right now are not performing very well.
So what does that tell you? That do they need to be redesigned?
They do. And part of this is you know, the regulations that require frontal crash safety have a car hitting a flat wall. So you've got the whole front end of the car that can, you know, manage the crash energy, and these cars do a great job at that. And then even we run a what we call a moderate overlap crash that looks like what happens when about half of the cars overlap with each other. And that's also an important crash, and all of these cars do very well in that crash. But that leaves this gap of, you know, sort of about one quarter of the front end of the car on either side, where there really isn't a lot of structure to absorb crash energy.
So let's say someone wants to buy one of these cars. Is it the right time, or should we be holding off? I think, is it Honda Fit that's going to be coming out with a new model? Should we wait for new models that might address some of these safety concerns if we're thinking about buying a Mini?
Well, Mini cars are at an inherent disadvantage out of the box just because they're light. Mass is a benefit in crashes. You want to be in the heaviest thing you can be in, to a point. We all don't need to be driving tanks, but bigger is better. And so you're already starting out shopping in a category where there's a fundamental disbenefit. To add to that, suboptimal crash test scores, I wouldn't think that this is your first choice for safety. And you would do well to upsize, and I'll use the example of the Honda Civic, does very well in this crash mode. It's only slightly larger, and there are options of the Civic that have, you know, very good fuel economy, hybrid versions, et cetera, et cetera. So I think there are better choices.
So let's say you've got a teenager at home. Do you want them driving one of these cars? Would you call these cars unsafe? Is that fair?
I don't think it's fair to call them unsafe. It's a new test. It's a new challenge. We're the first organization in the world to be evaluating vehicles in this crash mode. So I think right now what we're just looking at is a learning curve. Honda, for example, you mentioned them. The new Fit, they're very confident that the new Fit will do very well in this test. So it just takes time. Some of these changes are not things that you can throw on in you know, 1 month and get a product into the market. So unfortunately it takes time, but the good news is, you know, most of the major automakers are responding and changing their designs.
Is part of the problem here that in America there are more SUVs, more trucks on the road, and that, you know, you have a better chance of running into a vehicle that's bigger than you are?
Yeah, and that issue is called vehicle compatibility or incompatibility. That's also there because of the mass differential, and that's all the more reason that the smallest vehicles in the market need to really carry the best structural crashworthiness, because they're at that fundamental disadvantage right out of the box.
So are there safety features that you would recommend to manufacturers?
Well, for consumers, anybody shopping should purchase a vehicle, if they're looking in the used market, that has electronic stability control and also side airbags that protect your head. That's standard on all new vehicles now, but for folks shopping in the used market, those are huge features for safety.
And in the meantime, if you want to buy one, sounds like Chevy Spark is the safest one you found.
The Chevy Spark is the best bet. That vehicle has more work to do as well, but in this lot, they are the best.
Joe, thank you so much for coming on and talking about it today.
I enjoyed it. Thank you, Veronica.
That was Joe Nolan, Senior Vice President for Vehicle Research at the Insurance Institute for Highway Safety, talking about the Institute's recent tests on mini cars.
Every 10 years, the Wisconsin legislature redraws the boundaries of voting districts in the state. Throughout the years, and particularly after the most recent round of redistricting, there have been concerns that the process is a partisan one.
States like Iowa and California have set up independent commissions to draw district lines, and some are suggesting we do the same here in Wisconsin. This morning, Wisconsin Senators Dale Schultz and Tim Cullen held a meeting at the Capitol to talk about possible reform.
Here with us to talk about what that reform might look like is Ken Mayer, a professor of political science at UW-Madison. He spoke at the meeting this morning and is an expert on elections and on redistricting reform. Ken, thanks for joining us.
It's good to be with you.
I want to start with some of the basics for listeners who may not be aware of what's happened in Wisconsin in the last couple of years. As we mentioned, redistricting takes place every 10 years or so. In the last go-around, as you look at the redistricting maps, they are clearly heavily Republican.
Well, that's true. And it's not just that it's partisan. It needs to be stressed that if the Democrats were in control, they would have done much the same thing as they did in Illinois. The issue comes in that the process has become so partisan and so carefully calculated that it really is beginning to undermine basic notions of representation.
And so this morning, we've been hearing for the last couple of months, not the last couple of months, more like the last couple of years, ever since the new maps were drawn, about some of the problems inherent in the current system and what some of the solutions look like. This morning, Senator Schultz, Senator Cullen held a meeting to talk about some possible reform. You were there for that. What is the premise of this meeting? Dale Schultz and Tim Cullen, of course, a Republican and a Democrat there, talking about reform, but both moderates within their parties.
Right. The reform that they propose is modeled after the way that the state of Iowa does it. There, rather than the legislators or legislative leaders and consultants drawing the maps, it's a nonpartisan agency, basically their version of the Legislative Reference Bureau. And you have a couple of geographers, some council, and they draw the maps according to traditional redistricting criteria, population, district shape, and so forth. And they are not permitted by law to look at any political information. They're not allowed to look at party registration, past elections, not even allowed to look where incumbents live. And so the maps are drawn about as neutrally as you can. And then the plans go to the legislature, and the legislature has to vote to approve them or disapprove them. But as a rule, they're not allowed to make any changes. So it's a way of taking what has become an enormously partisan and acrimonious and here expensive as well process and routinizing it to the point where it's almost non-controversial there.
And how long has that system been in place in Iowa? Has it been there long enough to essentially prove itself?
It has. They started it, I believe, in 1980. And so they've had a number of different iterations, I think four. And it's essentially, it's very inexpensive. It's relatively non-controversial. And unlike the situation in Wisconsin, there has not been any litigation challenging the maps since 1980, whereas here in Wisconsin, it's routine. In fact, the last time, as best I can tell, that the legislature was able to redistrict legislative districts without judicial involvement was in the 1930s. And so litigation has become enormously common.
So at today's hearing, what was the sort of the general consensus there? Was everybody at the hearing in favor of this?
Yes, this was a hearing that the Republican majorities were essentially absent from. This was not an official hearing. It was informational. And so I think it's fair to say that everybody there was in favor of nonpartisan redistricting.
And you were on hand. You spoke. What was the message that you tried to impart?
Well, my message came from my experience as an expert witness, essentially a participant in the litigation in 2000 and this time around. And in my view, this process does not serve the people of Wisconsin well. It does serve the interests of the partisan majorities in the Assembly and the Senate, but just about every other consideration gets lost in the attempt to use that to the party, the majority party's advantage. And I think it's certainly at least worth discussing an alternative to see if there might be a better and a fairer, more neutral way to do it.
So do you get the sense, today's hearing, as you say, was chock full of people who support this idea. But do you get the sense that an actual discussion is taking place?
Well, there certainly is a public discussion. So far, there hasn't been any official legislative deliberation. The leadership in both the Assembly and the Senate has been very clear and consistent. They have no interest in this. They And this is understandable in the sense that if you're the majority party with control of this process, you're not going to be interested in giving that power up because it's very useful. The danger there is similar to what the Democrats faced in 2009, 2010, when they had unified control and the opportunity to implement a reform like this. They chose not to, thinking that they would be in control for the next redistricting cycle. Then you had the 2010 elections, Democrats were swept out, and you had unified Republican control. And so that was the message my colleague David Cannon tried to impart, that sitting here in 2014, the chances of unified Republican control after the 2020 elections is actually pretty small. At best, we're likely to have divided government, and it's conceivable, although unlikely, that you could even have unified Democratic control. And in that case, the Democrats would be the ones implementing a redistricting plan for their own advantage.
Now, a lot of the people that we've been talking about here are representatives or people who are very interested in the political process. Do you have a sense of what just plain old regular citizens think about this, whether they, A, know about it or care about it or frustrated about it or what?
Well, it's hard to say. For a lot of voters, this is a kind of inside baseball process issue that's all a bunch of politicians squabbling amongst themselves, and there are lots of other issues, the schools, property tax, and so forth, that are much higher priority. But you have seen some movement in other states. Now there are 22 states out of 50 that have taken the power to redistrict more or less out of the hands of the legislature. When this is put in front of voters, you had an initiative in California, an initiative in Arizona over the last couple of decades. If you can put the argument in front of voters and try to make it a matter of basic procedural fairness, you can sometimes get some traction, but it's certainly an uphill slog.
And why is that? Once you put the argument in front of voters, what is it about keeping the current system that makes it so compelling that makes it into that uphill slog?
Well, part of it is it can be complicated to explain. Part of it is if you are a supporter of the majority party, yeah, you're actually probably going to be okay with people using it to make sure that you can stay in power. And it's usually the members of the minority party who are the most vocal critics of it. But there's an element of basic fairness involved when the best analogy I can give is that this would be equivalent to letting the coaches for a football team actually serve as the referee in a Division I college football game. And that I think, offends most people's notions of basic fairness. And you can also point to a number of harmful consequences of the way that it's done when the legislatures do it. You get less competitive elections, you get more divisiveness, there's some evidence that you get more polarized politics. And so I think you can make the case that it can hurt the political process. But again, this is not the kind of issue that will grab people the way that a tax increase or a reorganization of the public school system would have a direct effect on people's lives.
There are those who argue that creating a commission such as the one you're suggesting, in fact, Assembly Speaker Robin Voss has said that creating that commission would not be accountable to voters.
Well, that's a very common complaint, and I think it's wrong, because right now the legislators, they don't actually draw the maps. The maps in the last four cycles here have either been drawn by federal or state Supreme Court justices or federal judges, which is almost entirely non-accountable. In this most recent round, it was very, very secret. There was virtually no public deliberation or discussion, and it was essentially a couple of legislative staffers and a consultant who drew the maps under the direction of the party leaders. And so the notion that there's an element of accountability here, I think, is just incorrect.
And as we sit here in 2014, we've got a ways to go. I mean, but if you want to start this process, you think it'll take at least that long to try to get something changed?
Well, the reason it has to happen early in the decade is that the closer you get to 2020, which is the election that will determine which party controls legislative houses and the governorship, because the census is taken in April of that year, it becomes easier to project who's going to be in control. And sometimes getting close doesn't help you get it right, as the Democrats learned in 2009. But sitting here in 2014, it's difficult to say with real confidence who's going to control the legislature in 2020. It's a presidential election year.
And we'll have to leave it there because we have to stop for news right now. Ken Mayer is with us, political science professor at UW-Madison. We're talking about redistricting.
And we'd love to get your take at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we are back now with Ken Mayer. He's a political science professor at UW-Madison and an expert on elections and redistricting reform. We're talking about the push for nonpartisan redistricting in Wisconsin in light of a hearing on the subject earlier today.
And we'd love to hear from you right now. How do you think redistricting should be handled in Wisconsin? And do you think you've been affected by the most recent redistricting round? You can give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
That's right, 800-642-1234. Do you think that redistricting in Wisconsin is important enough to merit a hearing like this? Do you think change is actually going to happen? Ken Mayer, before the break, you were talking about the whole cycle of this, and you were talking about the fact that as we get closer to the census, as we get closer to elections, the whole idea of even talking about this becomes very difficult at a political level.
Right. So if we were talking about this in 2019, or even early in 2020, you'd be able to make a pretty accurate assessment of who was going to be in control after the following election. Again, you're not always going to be right, but you'll have a much better idea then than you will now. And whichever party thinks that they're going to be in control is going to be completely uninterested in anything that would require them to give up that power. And so earlier in the cycle is, I think, you're more likely to get people to see it not necessarily in terms of their own political interests, but even in terms of protecting themselves in the event that they wind up in the political minority.
So is change we're talking about here, is it an all-or-nothing proposition, or is there some sort of middle ground, some sort of step that might at least get us to a place that you'd rather see us?
Well, short of amending the Constitution, which is very difficult here, as long as it is within the power of the legislature or legislative majorities to determine what the process is going to be at the time that you do the redistricting, it's hard to see anything that would really significantly improve the process. Even allowing formally a nonpartisan entity to officially draw up some maps, that would at least put on the table an alternative that would be under consideration at the time the legislature was acting. So it's really, there have been a number of different ways that states have tried to do this. There are some that create a bipartisan commission with an equal number of Democrats and Republicans. There are other states, Iowa, California, attempting to do it in kind of a nonpartisan way, but there is no easy way to do this because of the inherently political nature of the whole process.
So, coming out of today's hearing, what do you hope the result of that will be?
Well, I think the most likely result is that there will be continued public discussion about this. I don't think that there's much likelihood of legislative action in the next cycle. And in my view, the leadership in the Assembly and the Senate will change their minds and allow a hearing if they start hearing from people and the costs of not holding a hearing begin to approach the political costs of or exceed the cost of holding the hearing. But it really is going to be, I think, a bottom-up type of process if it's going to have an effect at all.
800-642-1234, if you would like to join in. 642-1234. If you've got an opinion, a question, or comment for our guest about the issue of redistricting in Wisconsin, the political districts that we're looking at right now, are they the best that we could hope for, or do you think that we could do better? Kamir, is this something that could ever wind up as part of a referendum in Wisconsin?
Well, only in the sense of a referendum to put in place a constitutional amendment, and that's difficult to do.
Mm-hmm.
It requires legislative approval in two successive sessions or two successive legislatures, and then it's put on the ballot. We're a little bit unusual from states like California, which have a direct initiative process, that it's a combination of legislative action and public approval.
So Senator Collins, Senator Schultz were the main forces behind this hearing today. Both of them, you know, sort of moderates within their own parties. Both of them also not coming back to the legislature. So where does that leave you? Who are your champions going to be in the state legislature going forward?
I couldn't tell you. I mean, I think that there is some support among Democrats for this, but it's difficult to see who, if there's ever going to be any kind of bipartisan move for this. That's a symptom of how difficult it is.
We've got some listeners who would like to join in. Room for you, too, if you would like, at 800-642-1234. Let's go to Eric, and Eric joins us from Beloit. Hi, Eric.
Hello. I have a question and a comment. My question is this redistricting problem, I guess, since that's what we're talking about, is this similar to what we used to refer to as gerrymandering, or is that term too old?
No, that's precisely what it's called. That gerrymandering comes from the early 19th century, when one cartoonist noticed that a state legislative district drawn for Elbridge Gerry, one of the founding fathers, looked like a salamander, which brought out the gerrymander. So it's basically synonymous.
And Eric, you had a comment.
Yeah, I'm curious because I followed this in some detail, not obviously as much as I probably should have, but it surprises me that people aren't more upset about this the way they are about, say, the Electoral College. And here's my point. You frequently hear during presidential elections, this comes up, you know, that, well, my vote isn't going to count because it's the Electoral College that does the election of the president, and therefore, in theory, a minority could elect a president. In a system, a situation like this with a district, it's possible to have your vote essentially not count because you don't have a statistically significant chance of electing someone from your party because of the way the district was set up. And do you see people getting upset like this, or is this part of the reason it's so hard to redistrict?
Well, I think that there are some people who are upset about this. The question is it the kind of issue that's going to be a concern of enough people who start asking their legislative leaders or candidates what they're going to do about it, if anything? I mean, one of the problems is we go through this once every 10 years, and by the time this comes around again, it's easy to forget. It's difficult to sustain attention for a long period of time. It's a difficult sell, certainly.
And so what's next here for redistricting reform? We had the hearing today. Is there anything else coming up on the horizon that you can point to and saying we're going to be meeting and talking about this?
Well, not that I'm aware of. I mean, my involvement is not as, you know, someone who's active in organizing and trying to generate pressure. I'm not sure what the next step, whether Senators Cullen and Schultz or any of the other interest groups that would like to see this, what they think is going to happen next.
And so I know people never like to speculate too much, but how hopeful are you that something will change before 2020 rolls around?
Well, it's probably not terribly likely. Certainly there are a lot of things that can change between now and then.
Well, Ken Mayer, thanks so much for joining us.
It's my pleasure.
Appreciate your time. We've been speaking with Ken Mayer, a political science professor at UW-Madison and an expert on elections and redistricting reform. A hearing on nonpartisan redistricting in Wisconsin was held earlier today at the state capitol.
It's time for Wisconsin Life. George Poeg moved to La Crosse as a young child in 1884. Locally, he was known as a scholar and a remarkable athlete. He went on to become the first African-American on the UW-Madison track team. But his greatest triumph came in the 1904 Olympics, when he became the first African-American to medal in the 200-meter and 400-meter hurdles. WPR's Maureen McCullum talked with UW La Crosse retired Special Collections Librarian Ed Hill about George Poeg's life as a student athlete in La Crosse.
He was the only black of his class, but he was the salutatorian of his class, that is, second ranked. He was regarded as a bright student, and of course he was a wonderful track star right from the beginning. He ran like the wind. He was described as running everywhere. He loved to run. I don't think that was common at the time, although athletics were important in local schools, as they are now. And there was a track team, but he was the star. And I think everybody recognized him, and the local papers frequently mentioned him as one of the fastest men in the world. He graduated in 1899 from La Crosse High School, and went on to UW-Madison and got a bachelor's degree there. He rose to the top wherever he was. In those times, outside organizations had a major role in placing athletes in competition. One of those organizations was the Milwaukee Athletic Club. And two or three people connected with the Milwaukee Athletic Club, the MAC, sponsored George's enrollment in the 1904 Olympics. But there was one other black runner that competed and medaled. George, we believe, was the first black Olympic medalist. It might have been only an hour or two ahead of the other one, but he was the first. It would have been a big deal. There were very few black athletes in that Olympics, and there were blacks who boycotted that event because the public stands were segregated. And some of the blacks who would have been there refused to participate. They boycotted it, and they asked George to boycott. But given his background, where he came from, and some of his major supporters and friends were white people, so I think he felt that he needed to participate in this event. He did very well. He did compete, and he medaled twice, and it set him up on a national stage, really. And as far as I know, he never competed, except perhaps in some local races, again. This is something I think, and some other friends of mine, colleagues, believe, that La Crosse should be giving far better, stronger recognition of this remarkable man as a scholar athlete. He was an Olympic medalist, and I see him as a role model, and I think the city intends to emphasize this aspect of somebody who was born into very modest circumstances, achieving local stardom, really, and Madison stardom, and then Olympic stardom. Here's something that kids can relate to. Look what he did. And he didn't just run. He got really good grades. You can do this.
Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. Find more Wisconsin Life on Wisconsin Public Television. The new TV series airs Monday night at 8 o'clock throughout February.
The Olympic Games are in full swing in Sochi, and while many of us are content to kick back on the couch and watch the competition, there are a lot of others who are saying, you know what, I think I could do that.
Well, if you're an aspiring Olympian or just someone who'd like to deliver a curling stone or two, you don't have to go to Russia. In fact, Wisconsin is a great place to try out lots of the Olympic sports you can see on TV. And getting started might be easier than you think.
Here to tell us about four Olympic sports that you can try right here in the state is Cheryl Anderson. She is a staff writer for the Appleton Post-Crescent, and she wrote a piece for WisconsinOutdoorFun.com looking at Olympic winter sports here at home. Cheryl, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, let's start out by describing or talking about the four sports. Let's list them, and then let's just talk about them in terms. So what are those four sports we're talking about?
Okay, the first is curling,
mm-hmm.
And then speed skating, And then biathlon, which is shooting things while you cross-country ski, which seems like an odd combination.
It does.
And then there's ski jumping, which is pretty self-defining.
It is self-defining. Well, let's start out with curling, because that's been getting a lot of attention lately. It's been an Olympic sport, I think, since the late 80s anyway. And there are lots of places to curl here in Wisconsin.
Right. And the one that we focused on, because we are based in Appleton, is the Appleton Curling Club. And curling has been around forever. It's like one of the oldest team sports in the world. They use these 42-pound stones that kind of look like flattened round loaves of bread, which is how I described it. And then kind of the idea behind it is to get your rock or your stone the straightest and the furthest. And I guess that's how you win.
That is how you win. And you just score it, and whoever gets closest to the target on the other end of the ice winds up being the winner.
Exactly.
And it's also, I have to say, as someone who has curled before, it is a good aerobic workout, because all of that sweeping actually does something. It looks a little goofy if you're not used to it, but
right.
it really is quite the sport. And it's been catching on, and as you say, lots of places to curl around Wisconsin.
Right, and our curling club here has been around for a long time. And one of the questions, too, I was asked about this is, does the Olympics generate interest in these sports in Wisconsin or closer to home? And the answer with everyone was yes. People want to check it out, even if it's just for, you know, to try it out, see what it's all about. But it is. It does have like an uptick when the Olympics are in session.
And I have to say, lots of places to try curling, including the Madison Curling Club, has an open house on February 22nd.
Oh, great. Okay.
So now, as someone who hasn't curled before, do you have to be an athlete to do this? I mean, obviously, if I try to figure skate or to ski jump, like we're going to be talking about, that would not happen, and it would end badly for everyone, most of all me. But can I curl, you know, without actually working out for a year and, I don't know, being really handy with a broom and stuff?
I would think that you could try it. I think it seems pretty easy to me. I think the person who throws the actual stone has a lot of, they have to really know what they're doing when they do that. And I think that, too, your friend there who has done it, it is a lot of work. I think trying it is not going to wipe you out, though.
That's good.
And I think that's fair to say it will not wipe you out.
Yeah.
All right. Well, that's what I want to hear, I guess, when I'm starting out. I want to move to another one that caught my interest. We're going to jump around in the list a little, but ski jumping, it seems you can try it in Wisconsin. Should you?
Not by accident.
Not by accident.
Personally, I would not want to just jump off a hill on skis, but, you know, that's just me. And I think that's something you really need training for. And I personally, from the people that I talk to, it seems like the earlier you start, the less fear you have. So if you're a young child and you're learning how to do that, you know, on a smaller hill, obviously, you can kind of work up to that where it's not a scary thing. But I think if, you know, me, you know, being 55, there is no way I'm going to jump off a hill on skis.
Right. And you interview people at one of these ski jump hills, and they say if you want to jump, you have to start at 4 years old.
Yeah, well, I guess
the ship has sailed for you and me, Gene.
It has. You know, I grew up near Westby, and the snowflake ski jump is great. And they've got a short hill for the kids.
Mm-hmm.
I was never one of those children, but there you go.
I'd like to think you're never too old, but it sounds like that might be what's
I'm
the case
old.
Here in
I'm
ski jumping.
I think that, well, too old for ski jumping. I would think these other two might be too old, too, for us, but it's personal.
Let's talk about the biathlete, because that one, you know, that is the one where you sort of do cross-country skiing, and then you stop, and then you do some target shooting, and then you do more cross-country skiing, right?
Yeah, I thought this was a really fascinating sport. It combines cross-country skiing with rifle marksmanship. And like I said, it seems really strange, but the word comes from the Greek for meaning two contests. And it was a sport in the original Olympics back in 1924, so that's pretty noteworthy. And I don't get the point of it.
Well, and I've heard that one of the great difficulties of it is that you're working really hard at cross-country skiing, and you're going up the hills and down the hills, and you're working up a sweat, and then you have to stop and do some very precise marksmanship you know, while your adrenaline is running and all of that. And it takes a lot of mental toughness to make all that happen.
Right. And it takes, like we were talking, this is a sport you have to have some physical strength and endurance to be able to complete, definitely.
Well, you can start with the cross-country skiing, mm-hmm. which is manageable.
Mm-hmm.
And then I guess you could build up to the marksmanship. Right?
I suppose you could do that, yes.
Gene's looking at me dubiously.
I'm very dubious about it.
All right, well, let's move to one that I think anyone who could skate could try. Speed skating. Is that something that's pretty accessible?
It's very accessible. And the neat thing that I found out when I was doing this story is the Pettit Center that's here is not only a place where, you know, you can go and learn how to speed skate in Milwaukee, but you're skating like side by side with some of these people that we're seeing on TV right now that are in the Olympics who train there. Kevin Butler, who's the director of marketing there, said it's kind of like a really cool community because you see these Olympians and they're skating and they're training and then they come off the track and then you go right on the same ice that they were practicing on.
And the Pettit Center, of course, is where all the Olympians train. Did you have the opportunity to try any of these sports while you were writing this story, or
no,
did you just observe?
Sadly, I didn't. And a lot of these, aside from the curling club, a lot of these were phone interviews. So no, sadly, I didn't get to try them. But I'm thinking I probably wouldn't have, personally. Maybe if there was something, you know, where you sit on the couch and watch TV sport, I could do that.
So I'm gathering here that in terms of you're never too old, that's really only true of curling.
So.
Yes, maybe skating.
I'll get my plug in for curling again. It's a life sport. You can play it very young till very old, and you can be competitive all the way through. So
and I think it's also like kind of a more social kind of a sport, too, that you do. You go and you have like curling club, just like people have, you know, bowling league kind of thing. So it's something that you do with other people, and there's a social aspect as well.
Are we seeing an uptick in interest in these sports as the Olympics hit the airwaves?
Oh, all of them, yes. And some are, like the curling club here in Appleton, they bank on that and they hold special open houses and learn to curl events so people can just try it out if they want. The Pettit Center also has an Olympic bump and they have people like kind of signing up and waiting to take classes to learn how to skate or to speed skate. Ski jumping, I'm not really sure because in our area, I talked to the Iola Ski Jumping Complex over here, and they really don't do a lot of lessons anymore. I guess people aren't really as interested in that, so that I don't know for sure. And then the biathlon, the two venues in Wisconsin, in Eagle and in Middleton, they said, too, they get people interested in just trying it out.
Well, lots of opportunity to try stuff. Cheryl, thank you so much for being here today.
Oh, thank you.
That's Cheryl Anderson, staff writer at the Appleton Post-Crescent, and we've got a link to her piece, Don't Let the Olympians Have All the Fun, on the Central Time Facebook page.